had not pressed record yet just then.
That's right. We are now on the air. So watch what you say. All right. So chapter 3 of the book of Daniel tries to answer for the Jews who have learned of chapter 2, what the heck is going to happen to us if Nebuchadnezzar and the Gentiles are going to rule us for who knows how long? Do we lose out on the Abrahamic covenant altogether? Are we at the mercy of Nebuchadnezzar all told? What's going to happen to us? Chapter 3 explains in principle how God will watch over and take care of the Jews in exile, even though they've been punished for their disobedience and their idolatry. He nevertheless will watch over the remnant that he wants to keep safe and sound. And so that's what chapter 3 is about. Chapter 3 answers the questions that the Jews probably have after reading chapter 2. So let's look at chapter 3 and see what the heck. By the way, there's an interesting principle we have in our New Testament scriptures, of course, 2 Peter 2:9. God is able to take care of his children while keeping the disobedient and so on sort of in bonds ready for punishment. 2 Peter 2:9, let me read that to you. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from testings and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. Interesting how he can do that, can't he? Take a pot full of a mixture there, and he knows how to take care of his while keeping the bad guys under judgment. That principle is what we'll see illustrated here in Daniel chapter 3. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, that's about 90 feet, and its width 6 cubits, about 9 feet. This is like the Washington Monument. It's an obelisk, tall and thin, tall and lean. And you set something like that out in a flat plain, and you can see it forever. And that's what he's done. He's put it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, a large flat area, so that it's readily observable for miles around. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, judges, magistrates, all the muckety-mucks in his kingdom to come to the dedication of this image. So this big obelisk, I suspect it's gold-plated. I wouldn't think he'd make that thing out of solid gold. I mean, you could, but people would be out there with their little hammers and chisels all the time, you know, trying to knock them off a piece if it was solid. But it's probably gold-plated. But he calls together everybody in his administration, the political muckety-mucks and the religious muckety-mucks, and so everybody who's anybody is invited to this dedication. They were all assembled for the dedication of the image, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language." In other words, everybody in the Babylonian Empire that they'd taken captive, all the slaves and everybody else that spoke whatever language they spoke. "At the moment that you hear the sound of some musical instruments," and they list a bunch of them there, and I don't know if it matters exactly what all, they're just some kind of a band of some kind. "When you hear that sound of musical instruments rip off, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." So there is a religious component to this thing, for sure, because it's being worshipped. It is like the idol capital of the world. The Jews hated this place because of the idolatry going on down there. But he says, you're going to fall down and worship my image here, which is both a representation of me and my God. And if you don't, verse 6, you're going to be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There's some of that negative motivation we saw before coming on the scene again. Going to torch you right on up if you don't do this. So clearly, it's punishable by disobedience is punishable by death in this guy's realm. Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the flute, lyre, all those instruments, they all fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So they do a trial run, and everybody hits the ground when they get the worshiping symbol sound. But not everybody hit the ground. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. Now, this is just a matter of time, isn't it? The Chaldeans, or certain ones of them at least, in the Chaldean society, Iraqi society, they're not pleased that the Jews have been given good positions in that government and or enjoying favored positions in the society and stuff like that. So they come and rat them out. And they said to Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, the spin doctors tie this back to his own decision, makes it hard for him to dance around it. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of all those musical instruments fall down and worship the golden image, and whoever does not fall down and worship be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. They remind him of his own edict. And verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed. Your guys, Nebuchadnezzar, your pet projects here, certain of them, and he named the three that we know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These, O kings, have disregarded you. Now, you could explain the dilemma in a several different ways, couldn't you? You could say, well, these guys are of a different religion than you are, and so they have chosen to not fall down and worship them. Or you could say, hey, these guys basically said that you're a monkey for putting that thing up, and they're not going to pay any attention to you. So they spin it so that he gets insulted the most that they possibly could. So these guys know how to manipulate, and they're doing it. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. So, hey, Nebuchadnezzar, what do you think of this? Your pet projects are basically blowing you off. How do you think he would respond? With kindness and generosity and understanding? In rage, he gave orders to bring in these guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Never good to have a hair trigger for a leader, is it? Guy who flies off in a rage when something doesn't go the way he wants. That's always dangerous for his citizenry. So he brings these guys before him. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to him, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? So if what I hear about you guys true, that you disregard me, now, if you're ready at the moment that you hear the sound of all this stuff, if you fall down and worship the image that I have set up, so be it. We'll call it even Stephen if you hit the ground like you're supposed to. But if you won't, you will immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? And there's the heart of the matter. Nebuchadnezzar thinks that there's nobody, no God, no one anywhere that can actually thwart his wishes, his plan here of persecuting these guys that disobey him. Now, the Jews reading this at this point in time would probably think to themselves, now, wait a minute. Our God can. Our God can thwart this guy. Maybe that's what is going to happen. Maybe God is going to show us that he can take care of us in spite of bozos like Nebuchadnezzar. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, verse 16, O Nebuchadnezzar, We do not need to give you an answer concerning this. I like these guys. We don't have to tell you anything, Hoss. Do whatever you want to do. We're not obligated to obey you. If it be so, is it going to be so? They don't know what God's going to do they? He hasn't made them a promise. They have the big broad brush promise of the Abrahamic covenant, and ultimately that will be fulfilled. But they don't know in this particular situation what God is going to do. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. So if God chooses, this punishment that you're laying out before us means nothing to us. He can protect us through that. Again, these are fairly young Jewish men, as we have seen before, with Daniel in the picture as well, making some pretty substantial spiritual decisions at a rather young age. I'm as impressed with these guys as I am Daniel. I'm very, very impressed with Daniel. He can deliver us out of this thing. But even if he does not, verse 18, and they recognize that there is an option for God. He can either protect them from the punishment or he cannot protect them from the punishment as he so chooses. There is a choice for him, and they don't know what choice he will make. They're leaving it up to him. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. So their answer is, hey, God can take care of us through this mess if he so chooses. But even if he doesn't so choose, we're not going to obey you. Slap, slap. That's some pretty strong standing and holding your spiritual ground that these guys display at this age, isn't it? I still got to give kudos to their parents. That's where I think they must have gotten their spiritual insight at this young age, because it just doesn't come from any other source, I don't think. So, the choice they make, the illustration for the exiled Jews living in Babylon is that certain ones of us are going to obey God no matter what the consequences. We choose to obey was the illustration that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego gave to the reading exiles who would be reading this book. We choose to obey God regardless of the consequences. That's our choice. Other people may make a different choice, but that's the choice they made. Their decision appears to be based not upon what God has done, but who God is. They know him to be sovereign ruler over men and events and things of that sort. And so they make a life or death decision based upon their commitment to obedience to their God. So the readers of this book going forward over the years can read this and say, hey, you know, work for these guys. Obedience brought blessing for these guys. I wonder if obedience will bring blessing into my life. And, of course, the answer is yes. That's the Deuteronomy theology there. Obedience brings blessing. Disobedience brings judgment. And so the message is one for the subsequent readers. So, going on with the story, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward these guys. That big grin that he had on his face going from ear to ear got wiped off when they told him that, didn't it? He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more foolish than it was usually heated. How hot does a fire have to be to burn human flesh? Regular fire will do that, won't it? Some of these forest fires that they had out west, I was reading a deal one time online where, this was in Montana, this guy had him a gun safe, a large fireproof gun safe that he kept his rifles and stuff in, and a forest fire came through there, burned his house down. They found his gun safe melted on the floor and everything in it melted with it. So that forest fire was hot enough to burn that, I think it was rated for like 15 or 17 or 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, burnt that suckered into a pile of molten metal. This guy's got his kiln worked up there about the same temperature. He's pumped it up 7 times hotter than normal, which you don't really need. But he's so enraged that he isn't thinking. And he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up these 3 guys in order to cast him into the furnace of blazing fire. So they were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothing. They were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. So he gets his heavy hitter guys, tie these guys all up without even taking their clothes off or anything like that. Normally you would think, well, who cares? And they try to get these guys chucked into this furnace. Now, I don't know how this thing is made. I guess there's some kind of a ramp from the top down into it so that they could throw people down the ramp and you'd land in the furnace somehow or another, I guess. I don't know. But because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They couldn't get close enough to chuck them into the furnace without themselves losing their life to just try to get these 3 guys thrown into the furnace. Now, wouldn't you think that this Nebuchadnezzar would maybe call time out for a second and say, wait a minute, let's think this through here a little bit, guys. I can't even get you thrown into my furnace to punish you because my guys are getting burned up trying to get you in there. So let's rethink that. Maybe we don't need it to be this hot. You know, none of that kind of reasonable thinking appears to have taken place. He's just cost his own men their lives because of his rage. But these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. So they got in there somehow or another, probably wrapped up kind of like mummies with their clothes still on them. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astounded, and he stood up in haste. I guess he had him a front row seat to watch the festivities there. And he responded and said to his high officials, was it not 3 men that we cast bound into the midst of the fire? And they answered and said to the king, yeah, it was 3, certainly, O king. And the answer said, look, I see 4 men, and they're all loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods, like a theophany, a appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ, probably. Could be another angel, but I think it's probably the Savior. So he has come and joined him. And what's going on? Well, they're just having a good old time. They're just walking along, talking to one another. The string, the ropes, whatever they use to tie them up, look like it burnt off of them, and they're free to walk around and visit with God. Now, there's no possible natural explanation for this. It has to be divinely wrought. A fire of this nature cannot possibly not burn people and their clothing. So, you just have to accept what it is. It's a miracle. Now, does that mean that the readers of Daniel's book, the exiled Jews down in Babylon, should conclude that every time they get between a rock and a hard place, God's going to work a miracle on their behalf? That's stretching things a little bit. But the principle is that he clearly has chosen, in this case, to oversee and protect his faithful children, the obedient ones, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded to the three of them and said, "Come out, servants of the Most High God, and come here." So he knows who these men are obeying, and he knows who they're not obeying. They're not obeying him. But he knows they are obeying their God. Probably knows it's also Daniel's God. So he calls them out, addresses them by servants of the true God. So they come out. And all these high muckety-mucks that he'd gathered together, gathered around and checked them out. The fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged. They didn't even lose a pair of pants in the process. Nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. The deliverance was so great and so thorough that there's no evidence of any sort of effect on these guys by the fire.
Well, this is a good contrast to God's protection. Pharaoh's armies, you know, when they hit the water, as they crossed the water, they weren't even wet, you know, and that was God's protection.
Yeah, when they walked across the Jordan, going into the Promised Land.
Yeah,
walked across the Jordan, well, or the Red Sea, Moses' deliverance at the Red Sea. Either one would be an illustration of the same thing. You're right. They didn't even get their feet wet. Here, these guys don't even get the smell of the fire smoke on their clothing. The deliverance is so thorough that you wouldn't even know they'd been in there. And yet the guys, these valiant warriors of his trying to get them in the place, they end up getting burnt up, just getting close enough to try to throw them in the thing. Clearly, it is a divine deliverance. It is a principle that the exiles now can cling to going forward, that regardless of what the Gentiles do to them under this broad-based eschatology we saw described there in chapter 2, no matter what happens, God is there to protect his own. So Nebuchadnezzar now responds to all of this. Verse 28, and he said, "Well, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command." He recognizes who they trusted and who they disobeyed. Who they obeyed and who they disobeyed. The difference between him and God is illustrated by the absence of any impact from the fire. And violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Now Nebuchadnezzar is showing a little sense here. He recognizes the difference in worthiness between himself and the God of these three men, which is a good thing for him. He's going to need to learn that better than he does now, but he will. So therefore, I'm going to make a decree. This experience has prompted me to make a decree. And that decree is that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there's no God, no other God who is able to deliver in this way.
Didn't learn that much.
Yeah. He learned at least some things, didn't he? He learned that, wait a minute, man, this is the God that these guys are obeying and following. This is not your everyday run-of-the-mill God that we got down here in Babylon. I mean, look at these guys. They got delivered, and everything was great and wonderful, and he's clearly on a different plane than our gods. And so he gave bennies to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and caused them to prosper in the land of Babylon. That would be, one would think, a comforting message for the Jewish exiles, wouldn't it? To read this story and see that people who obeyed their God, the Jews' God, the only God, that people who obeyed him were greatly blessed by him, even in this horrible, Gentile, dominating, godless, idolatrous environment. Wouldn't that be comforting if you want them living down there? So chapter 3 is a great big band-aid to put on chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a beatdown for the Jewish peoples. Chapter 3 is an encouraging reminder of the faithfulness of their God and that the Deuteronomy principle of obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings judgment is still at work, still applied. It even is down to this day. And it's good to have chapter 3 after chapter 2 in it for the readers of this history to know what's going on. Any question about chapter 3 before we move on and how it fits into the overall narrative, how things are developing here? See what's going on? Yes, Jen.
A question, it's an observation. Personally, I think the most important thing is that in this chapter is where they say, even if he doesn't, because we know that sometimes things don't work out, but that's immaterial.
Yeah. Janet's point is that the decision to obey God here was not based upon a guaranteed result. Their decision to obey God was based upon the principle of life. They're going to obey God no matter what. If things work out well, good. That's frosting on the cake of life, so to speak. But if they don't, so be it. We're still going to obey God. And that's a lifestyle decision, isn't it? That we all have to make. You know, we're going to obey God when things are bad, when the chances of loss are great and that sort of thing, or are we not? And they said, yes, we are. And so they did. And you're right, that is probably the most striking point of chapter 3 was the decision and the basis for it that the three guys made.
What they point out to Nebuchadnezzar is that, because Nebuchadnezzar said, who is going to be able to, to save you?
That's right.
And if God is able, he is able to do anything.
Yeah.
Whether he does or not is up to him, but he's capable.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't you think at this point in Nebuchadnezzar's experience, when Daniel explained to him when he was giving him the vision of the statue that God has granted to you, Nebuchadnezzar, these various things, several times he said that. Here, it is demonstrated that God's much greater than he, Nebuchadnezzar, is. Wouldn't you think that maybe he's coming around to understanding that God controls the affairs of men? Wouldn't you think that? This guy's a slow learner.
There are some things that are not granted to you.
God kind of wrapped the principle around the two before and smacked him in the head with it a few times, and he still isn't picking up quite on that point. So chapter 4 sort of, in essence, says, well, let's go about this a little different way, Nebuchadnezzar. You're not learning the lessons as the easy way. I'm presenting them to you so that you can learn them the easy way, but you're choosing not to learn them the easy way. So let's learn it the hard way. Let's make you a cow for a while. And let's see if that gets through that thick skull of yours. And maybe you'll come around. So that's chapter 4. Now, the principle's already been illustrated in his book several times. We don't need chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar needs chapter 4, but we get the point right off the bat. God controls the affairs of men. Chapter 1 starts making that point. God gave the Jews to Nebuchadnezzar. God did this. God did that. All of that is clear enough, but not to Nebuchadnezzar. Well, let's see how far we get into this next experience. Verse 1, chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all the peoples, nations, and every language that live on all the earth, may your peace abound. Sounds like an oracle coming up here, doesn't it? It seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. Now, that's reasonable behavior. It seems good. I want to tell you about this God and what he's done for me. That seems like a good thing to me, to tell you about God. Kind of like his progression here. He's moving a little bit in the right direction, it seems. So here's what it is. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders? His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. That's some pretty decent spiritual insight, isn't it? If his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, then clearly he's sovereign over all the other gods, if there are any other somewhere, because his kingdom, God's kingdom, lasts forever. Theirs don't. So he seems to be moving toward a little bit of understanding here. And his dominion is from generation to generation, which included it right now. And so he goes on with the story of how things happened. He says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace, and I saw a dream. This is his second one now. And it made me fearful. This one scared the bejabbers out of me, just like the first one did about the statue. Here's another dream I had, and this one was an awesome dream as well. And these fantasies, as I lay on my bed and the visions of my mind, kept alarming me. What I saw and what I dreamed was bothering the heck out of me. So I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. I called together all my team again. And so here they all came, magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, diviners, all these guys. And I related the dream to them. This time he tells them the dream. They didn't have to interpret the dream. He tells them the dream. But they could not make out its interpretation. So unlike chapter 2, where they had to come up with both the dream and the interpretation, all they got to do now is make up something that fits the dream as he told it to them. They still can be a charlatan and try to smoke one past him. But in this case, at least he didn't require them to come up with the dream. But finally, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. Doesn't sound like he's quite a believer yet, does it? He's still worshiping his God. That's certain. And in whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and I related the dream to him, saying, O Belteshazzar, remember Daniel, chief of the magicians, since I know that a spirit of the holy gods is in you and no mystery baffles you, tell me the visions of my dream which I have, along with its interpretation. Now, apparently Daniel hasn't even been told the dream yet. The other guys were, but Daniel had. Now, these were the visions, so he's going to tell him. So Nebuchadnezzar is going to tell Daniel. So verse 10, these were the visions of my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. Great big tree. This guy must think he's from Texas or something. You know, the statue is big. The tree is big. Everything got to be big. It grew large and became strong, and its height reached into the sky, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its foliage was beautiful, and its fruit was abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the sky dwelt in its branches. And all living creatures fed themselves from it. Man, beasts, and birds are all benefiting from this humongous tree. And I was looking in the visions of my mind, and I lay on my bed, and behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven. Some sort of heaven representative here. Don't know whether it was angelic or another theophany or exactly what. But he shouted out and spoke as follows. Chop down the tree and cut off its branches. Strip off its foliage and scatter its fruit. And let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, and yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground. But put a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field. So six times this tree is referred to as an it. It's a thing. Person, place, or thing. It's a noun, right? An it. But going on with the story, he says in verse 15, second half, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Now all of a sudden that it has become an him. It's a person now, not a thing. And let him, verse 15, share with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let him share with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him. Now this tree all of a sudden, which has become a person all of a sudden, is now going to become an animal all of a sudden. And let seven periods of time pass over him. Five times the tree is now referred to as a him, a person. So he went from a thing to a person and to a beast. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones. And what is the purpose of all of this? In order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows on it whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. He's already been taught that principle a few times. But this purpose of this vision is to teach it to him, apparently in a way that is absolutely unforgettable. So the storyline looks like something great and mighty and wonderful that was benefiting everybody and everything gets cut down. But there is a band put around the bottom of it which holds it intact, maintains the life that is left in the root system under the tree. And the tree all of a sudden becomes a person, and that person is changed into an animal. Are you familiar with the term boanthropy or lycanthropy? Lycanthropy, I think, is a study of werewolves. Boanthropy is a study of humans who think they're cows. Bovine, boanthropy. So there's a known disease, a mental disorder, where people think they are animals. And they behave and act like animals. It looks like he's going to contract something like that. Something like boanthropy. It's actually known. I mean, it's not something made up or something divinely implied in this particular case. There's a bunch of people around. Some people think they're werewolves. I had a grandson one time, I think, thought he was a werewolf the way he was combing his hair and not shaving his beard. Fortunately, he wasn't. He never bit me or anything. Just looked like one.
There's a guy in Russia who's had surgery. I think it's in Russia, who's had surgery so that he looks like a collie.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, a Japanese guy.
He's on all fours.
Yeah. Yeah, he may have some form of this.
Wow.
So that's the basic dream. Tree, cut down, banded so that it doesn't totally die. The tree itself then becomes human, and the human then transitions into animal-like thought and behavior, and that's the vision. Verse 18, this is a dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belshazzar, tell me its interpretation, as much as none of the wise men of my kingdom was able to make known to me the interpretation, but you're able, and the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Tell me, what the heck does this mean, Daniel? And if you want to know what it means, you got to come back. We're running out of time. We'll go through the explanation of it next week. It seems a shame in many ways that Nebuchadnezzar, who has had ample opportunity to see the sovereignty of God at work in his own life, has to go through something this drastic to learn the lesson, I guess, permanently, or whatever the case may be. But that appears to be what will happen. So we'll go through it next time and check out how the guy fares. So chapter 1 sets the stage. Chapter 2 gives the Jewish readers a rather dismal picture of their future. Chapter 3, on the other hand, is an encouragement for living in obedience to God through that dismal future. And chapter 4, as we'll see, involves this particular individual learning the lesson that indeed God can do that, can't he? He can make their lives good and fine and blessed because he controls the affairs of every man, woman, child, and nation, as the case may be. So the storyline is kind of unfolding in a difficult start, discouraging start, but it's getting a little brighter as we work along through here. Questions or comments about anything we've seen so far?
You would think Nebuchadnezzar would have just gone straight to Daniel because he was so freaked out that Daniel knew the first dream without being told.
Yeah, you got to wonder, well, what's wrong with this guy? He knows who his main man is. Why is he messing with these other knuckleheads? They never told him anything amounted to anything. Go get the guy who knows what he's talking about and get straight to the bottom of this thing.
That's for us.
Beg your pardon?
That's for us. We keep going to the wrong people. We keep forgetting to go directly to God.
Yeah.
We ask our neighbors, we ask our spouse, we ask therapists, we ask teachers. We should be just going directly to God.
Well, and we got to remind ourselves that he appears to still be a non-believer at this point in time, so he's not exactly making the best spiritual decisions on the planet, so that may be part of it as well. We'll let you truck out of here, and if you find my projector or anything laying around your house, or anywhere, bring it back, would you? We'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing. Did y'all get a piece of fudge? Everybody get a bite?
Did they take the trash can as well?
They got the desk. It looks like they got the trash can.
Wow.
Man, I tell you, I don't understand.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we'll keep